Good afternoon, or depending where you're at, and thank you for joining us for this pancreatic cancer and EPI webinar hosted by the National Pancreas Foundation. My name is Jenny Pagel-Guile, and I am the Executive Director. And just wanted to thank you for joining us again. This is part of our mission to support education for our care providers to move treatment and awareness forward within the field of medical providers, and this gives us a great opportunity to reach a variety of providers. The MPF has awarded over $5 million in grants over our history. We endorse over 185 centers of excellence. And for patients and physicians, we have a base of over 30 programs. So educational programs like this, in-person, virtual, and other opportunities to engage. If you are interested in volunteering, or if you have a patient who's passionate about being involved with the National Pancreas Foundation, please reach out to us. We are entering the Pancreas Bowl season right now, so we have several bowling events. We have other folks that do DIY fundraisers across the country. We also do advocacy and tabling opportunities across the country. So based on where you are, who your partners are, who your patients are, and what their interests are, we would be happy to connect them to share more information about the National Pancreas Foundation and our services. Mark your calendars. Next week, we'll be in Boston, Massachusetts for one of our celebrations, awarding our patients and care providers and thanking them for their service to the MPF community. We have a robust calendar. So if any of these markets are near you, please reach out to volunteer or participate. We would love to see you when we're in person. Also, applications are open for our 20th anniversary Fellows Symposium. It's taking place in Tempe, Arizona in March. So make sure if you know a fellow or somebody that's interested in staying in the pancreatic space, we have a great agenda for the week. It's CME accredited, and we would love to see as many folks as possible with us at that opportunity. Also, if you're a center of excellence and you don't have a bowling event going on, or if you're interested in fundraising, if there's something going on, we have DIY fundraising opportunities. We have a website you can sign up and register for. Also, reach out to Sock, Paul, and Carrie. They'd be happy to assist you along the way. We know it's not a one-size-fits-all. All offices are different, so we'd be happy to connect you in a way that makes sense for your team. We have many more opportunities pre-recorded online for you to learn on a variety of topics, so feel free to check out our medical professional portal. We have webinars, free CME opportunities. You can be with any institution. You don't have to be with a center of excellence. We want to educate everyone in the field. So if you have emergency room staff or other folks or community hospitals in your area, these are great resources in a variety of topics, timeline, and a lot of institutions are now using some of these for onboarding their new staff. So please check these out. And we're always looking for speakers. So reach out to us if you have an interest in that as well. As always, you can follow us on social media. And we have a monthly newsletter that goes out, and we do a lot of our announcements on Facebook and LinkedIn. Dr. Legresti was great about promoting this event on his LinkedIn as well. So feel free to stay connected in the ways that make sense to you and your social media habits. We have several other webinars coming up. On November 7th, there is another pancreatic cancer webinar. And then coming up next week, we have another one as well. Again, you can register on these on our website or through the QR codes that you'll see in post-event emails. November 24th, November is a big month for us. It's Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. So we have a lot of information going out there and very robust panels for all of our opportunities. And again, December 8th, one of the last ones of the year, we'll be talking about endocrine and exocrine with Dr. Bellin and Dr. Yadav. And again, we are going to dive into today's topic, going through these. So I'm happy to introduce our speakers and thank them for their time today. Dr. Legresti is an expert in endoscopy, ultrasonography, ERCP, and advanced endoscopy treatments for gastrointestinal malignancies with a special focus on early diagnosis and treatment of pancreatic cancer. He serves as chief of gastroenterology at Hackensack University Medical Center, associate professor at Hackensack Meridian School of Medicine, and medical director of the New Jersey chapter of the National Pancreas Foundation. He is a fellow of the American Society of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy. He trained at the New York Hospital and completed gastroenterology and advanced endoscopy fellowship at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. Another person from his team joining us today is Dina O'Connor. She's a nurse practitioner at the John Thayer Cancer Center in Hackensack, New Jersey, specializing in GI malignancies. She graduated from Northeastern University and completed her clinical training at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Dana-Farber in Boston, Massachusetts. Michelle Mamus is a registered dietitian who earned a Bachelor of Science from the University of Delaware before completing her dietetic internship at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, a Harvard teaching hospital in Boston, and she works at the John Therapy Cancer Center, where she specializes in providing medical nutrition therapy for patients with gastrointestinal cancers. Again, thank you to our panel, and I'm now going to turn over to Dina to start off our discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me. Dr. Legresi, you ready for my questions?
Absolutely. Fire away.
What do current statistics tell us about the impact of pancreatic cancer?
And thank you to the National Pancreas Foundation for hosting this. You know, I've been a participant with them for many, many years. They're a great organization, and really they serve this important purpose, which is bringing, you know, strange, interesting topics in medicine to the forefront. And pancreas cancer certainly is one of those. Even though for us on the call and on the Zoom, you know, it's a, you know, something that we see all the time, it's certainly not a common cancer. You know, I'm sure I don't have to tell this audience, you know, how things have improved over the years, but it's still a tough and uncommon cancer to deal with. In 2025, there's an estimated 67,000 patients who were diagnosed with pancreas cancer. And unfortunately, almost the same number of deaths, about 52,000 deaths in 2025, for a five-year relative survival of about 13%, which is better than when I first started doing this, when it was about 5% five-year survival. So yay oncology, they're doing a great job in trying to improve things. Unfortunately, as we've seen, the main reason for such horrible disease outcomes is that most patients with pancreatic cancer present in late stage. I think, you know, I can't remember, you know, the last time outside of a screening protocol that we find patients who have pancreatic cancer at localized, confined to the pancreas sites and stage. Most patients have, unfortunately, advanced disease locally or metastatic disease, and that contributes to the advanced and poor survival. How common is this cancer? You know, and as we said, it's an uncommon cancer. You know, your overall lifetime risk of developing pancreatic cancer is about 1 in 65, or about 1.5%. So 1.5% lifetime risk sounds kind of like a low number, but your chances of getting, you know, struck by lightning certainly is much, much higher. How common is it in the United States? It's the 10th most common cancer. But still, if you think about, you know, what we look like worldwide, it's a more common cancer than that, anticipated probably by 2040 to be the number two cause of cancer mortality in the world, which is, again, a very kind of sobering statistic. Who dies from this cancer? It's basically patients, you know, kind of male, female, kind of fairly equivalent, a little bit more preponderance of men who die from this. But predominantly, you know, it's a disease that affects kind of all comers fairly equally. There's a slight preponderance of non-Hispanic Black patients who get the disease, but clearly a relative preponderance of equality between men and women. Except in the more recent years, we found that there is probably a slight increase in women getting this cancer overall. But overall, if you look at all patients across the world, there's a significant and steady increase in incidence across the board. And again, it's one of those few cancers out there where the incidence is actually rising worldwide. So it's an unfortunate statistic. It's something that, you know, we're seeing more and more of. And as you'll see as we dive into this you know, lecture today, there's a lot we can do for patients despite all of these kind of sobering statistics. And there's a lot we could do to make patients potentially live longer, but more importantly, have better quality of life. So on that note, I'll just turn back over to Dina, and we'll kind of dive into some of the nitty-gritty about pancreatic cancer, but more importantly, some of the side effects of pancreatic cancer that we will dive into, especially this entity called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. So, Dina, what are the two types of pancreatic cancers that we see commonly? And more importantly, do they present in a kind of different way than, you know, than other cancers of the abdomen?
How long do we have for this episode? 30 minutes?
Exactly.
I could probably talk about this one topic for 30 minutes, but let me summarize it for you the way I've learned it over the years. So pancreatic adenocarcinoma arises from our exocrine cells or our ductal cells, which produce our digestive enzymes. Pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma consists of 90% of all pancreatic tumors, which holds true in our practice amongst our three GI medical oncologists. It is the most common pancreatic malignancy. They tend to be very aggressive, they're fast growing, and they spread early, typically to lymph nodes, liver, and peritoneum. They're often diagnosed in late stages, as we know. We stage them based on TNM staging, and they're best seen on CT, MRI, and PET, and that is patient dependent. Early signs of pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma are often nonspecific or absent, and that's why this is diagnosed in later stages. But general symptoms include abdominal pain, which can be dull, upper abdominal, sharp, and radiating to the back is common in later stages. They can have abdominal pain that's worse after eating, so postprandial pain, or worse when laying down. Jaundice is more prevalent in tumors in the head of pancreas due to biliary obstruction. That can cause yellowing of the skin and eyes, pruritus of the skin, pale stool, weight loss and appetite loss, unfortunately, is very common due to the metabolic demands, of the cancer itself. We do find that there's a lot of new onset diabetes, especially in older adults with no prior risk factors, which may precede the cancer diagnosis itself. Fatigue is extremely common due to malnutrition and malabsorption. DVTs, steatorrhea, early satiety, back pain, vomiting due to pending gastric outlet obstruction, and depression and mood issues. The tumor location does affect what you're seeing. So again, the head of the pancreas is more likely to cause jaundice, and a mass in the body or tail is more likely to cause pain or weight loss without jaundice. Overall, the prognosis is very poor. In contrast, pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, they arise from the endocrine cells, which produce insulin, glucagon, et cetera. And those are very rare. About less than 5% of our patient population are pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. The symptoms are very vague. They're often found incidentally. They're typically slower. They're slower growing than adenocarcinoma, and they're variable, varying from indolent to aggressive with small cell neuroendocrine cancers. They may metastasize liver or bone, depending on the grade. Diagnosis and staging-wise, these are grading based on Ki-67 index and mitotic rate. So they range from low, intermediate, and high grade. Low-grade or well-differentiated tumors are grades 1 through 2, and they're typically indolent or slow-growing. High-grade or poorly differentiated are grades 3, and they are fast-growing and aggressive. Imaging for these, depending on the type of tumor, CT, MRI, a PET dotatate, which is a somatostatin receptor imaging. We use those in low-grade, well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors, and an FDG PET for high-grade, poorly differentiated neuroendocrine tumors. Surgery, of course, is recommended if it's localized, or somatostatin analogs like octreotide and lanreotide can be used. The prognosis for pancreatic neuroendocrine is often better than adenocarcinoma, especially if it's low-grade, localized, and resectable.
Yeah, so I'll
all right, ahead. Dr. Legrassi.
Go ahead.
Tell me some of the key risk factors for pancreatic cancer, and how does that influence a patient's risk and screening recommendations?
Thanks, Dina. So basically, you would think that there would be some well-defined risk factors that we'd be able to kind of put our finger on and say, hey, this is definitely something that causes pancreatic cancer. But overall, we found, that there are two big categories, modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. The modifiable risk factors that we see are your typical kind of cancer-causing risk factors, so cigarette smoking, obesity, alcohol use. So if you remember earlier when I talked about what the overall lifetime risk for the patients for getting pancreatic cancer were, so like I said, about 1.5% lifetime risk, think about each one of these additional risk factors roughly doubling the risk from 1.5%. So cigarette smoking, for example, is about a 1 to 2-fold increased risk above the average patient's risk. So obesity, again, about 1.5 times increased risk. Alcohol use, again, 1.5 times risk. But then there's non-modifiable risk factors like diabetes. So patients who are diabetic can, again, roughly double
the risk of getting pancreatic cancer over the baseline. And then there's the most important thing that we see in our surveillance clinic is patients who are at increased family risk. I often tell patients, these are kind of the low-hanging fruit risk factors, right? So if patients, you know, have multiple family members with pancreatic cancer, you know, you kind of look at each family member that's a first-degree relative who has pancreatic cancer, roughly doubles or even triples the risk of pancreatic cancer in their individual risk profile. So again, it's not uncommon to find patients will walk in and they say, yeah, mom, mom's mom, and also my great aunt happened to have pancreatic cancer. Oh, and maybe they had breast cancer too. Then we start thinking, wait a minute, you know, and no one has said, hey, wait a minute, there might be an increased risk of pancreatic cancer for you. Now, again, family history is important. And then we start to dive into the family history a little bit with the help of our geneticists. And then we start to see, okay, well, is there any particular gene that we can associate with family risk or set of genes? And again, it's not still a common thing. We still see, even with families, sporadic cancer being the most common. But in about 20 to 25% of families who have pancreatic cancer risk, we can identify a particular germline mutation in cancer-promoting genes. For example, things like BRCA1 and 2, ATM mutations, PALB2. There's a host of them that certainly increase risk overall. And if you kind of sat back and said, well, what about, you know, what are these predisposition genes and what the risk looks like? Probably of all the genes that you can probably have, you know, BRCA2 might be probably the worst one because it increases the risk so high, roughly up to 7 times higher risk above the baseline population. So again, the cancer's baseline population risk may be low, but even with an increased risk, the rate still may be low. But these are patients who theoretically you can identify early and then potentially surveil and screen. And there's a whole host of these that we've talked about already, but some of them are in particularly associated with pancreas and pancreas inflammation patients. For example, patients that have mutations in cystic fibrosis genes and also PRSS or PRESS. These mutations cause a condition called hereditary pancreatitis. Patients have pancreatitis from a very young age, and then they certainly can be at increased risk. So clearly there are well-defined risk factors. You know, there's also this entity that I touched on briefly earlier, new onset diabetes. It's a little rough to decide what new onset means, but basically it's patients who don't have a family history of diabetes, don't have risk factors for diabetes, and present with diabetes under the age of 50. Again, that should be a big giant red flag saying, hey, I better look at this patient's pancreas, and oftentimes, you know, referring physicians don't. You know, why is that important? Because it's about a 1% chance that patients who present with new onset diabetes will in fact have pancreatic cancer. And they won't just have diabetes, garden variety diabetes, which again sounds like a low number, but in this field, as we'll cover, every little bit helps here, and every little bit of detecting these diseases earlier increases the patient's chance for survival. So in any event, we touched on a little bit about pancreatic insufficiency. We touched a little bit about how that may play a role here. We also touched on genetic risks and family risk. I'll turn the attention back over to this whole concept of exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. And more importantly, you know, what is it? You know, what is this whole condition? You know, why is it that we're actually having this conversation today? What are the key signs and symptoms of patients of EPI? And why does it kind of connect somehow to pancreatic cancer? We know that, you know, exocrine pancreatic insufficiency is not a commonly thought about diagnosis. But if you stop and thought about, you know, why should that even matter? Again, you'll see as we talk about it in the next few minutes, it's one of those things where we should be paying attention to it. Not only is exocrine pancreatic insufficiency important in patients, in patients' overall symptom feeling, but more importantly, it just goes along hand in hand with how we treat patients better. So going back to what exocrine pancreatic insufficiency is, it's a maldigestion syndrome. It's characterized by reduced pancreatic enzyme production, secretion, or activity, and it results in malabsorption of nutrients, which we'll talk about shortly. And in the setting of pancreatic cancer, certainly, there are a number of etiologies that we'll cover that can certainly explain some of why EPI is so important. So I'll just turn my attention back over to Dina. So what do you think? Why is EPI so common in pancreatic cancer patients? You know, what are the main causes of EPI in that condition? And really, why is EPI so underdiagnosed in oncology?
So our pancreas produces three enzymes, lipase, protease, and amylase. By the time we see patients, they've either been resected and they are going to start adjuvant treatment with us. So they've been missing part of their pancreas, whether it be a distal pancreatectomy or a Whipple. So obviously the pancreas is not producing those enzymes and they are symptomatic. And that's the issue with the symptoms, is that there is no standard of care with looking at the symptoms. You can have one patient who's had a Whipple and they have very little symptoms, and then the next patient you see is that they are riddled with classic EPI symptoms. Unfortunately, it's very common in our patients with pancreatic cancer because both the disease and sometimes even the treatments can damage or obstruct the parts of the pancreas responsible for producing and delivering digestive enzymes. As more pancreatic tissue is removed, destroyed, or compromised, the enzyme production drops rapidly and leads to maldigestion and nutrient loss. Common symptoms, unfortunately, they're vague, but you know, we do have some red flags that we keep our ears out for. Symptoms range from bloating, gas, diarrhea, weight loss, vague abdominal pain or discomfort, especially after meals, steatorrhea, but these often mimic common issues with or without cancer, such as gastroesophageal reflux, IBS, or side effects of our treatments, which are very common. Quite often, clinicians can attribute symptoms to chemotherapy or the cancer itself rather than the actual functional enzyme loss. We try to improve clinical awareness of EPI so that we can improve patient outcomes. Many of the chemotherapies that we give can cause bloating, gas, diarrhea, and weight loss. So it's important to find this patient population early and treat it early so that it's not confused with side effects of chemo. Dr. Legresti, you and I talk about this quite often. How would you explain the overlap of EPI symptoms with the cancer itself?
Well, you know, in the end of the day, like again, all these patients have, you know, failure of gut, right? So what does that look like? It looks very similar to, you know, a lot of the symptom complexes that patients present with other failures of gut. So patients, like you said earlier, they can have SIBO, you know, and you'll never know the difference between small intestinal bacterial overgrowth symptoms and pancreatic cancer. But also, patients might
Absolutely.
have underlying irritable bowel syndrome, and that's also like a mimicker of exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, right? So the main symptoms of early exocrine pancreatic insufficiency are exactly what you kind of touched on there, Dina. Basically, you have gas, bloating, loose stools, diarrhea, discomfort after eating, right? You know, so all of that, I mean, that's super common. I mean, that's probably the number one thing that patients will come into a gastroenterologist for. And obviously, the majority don't have pancreatic cancer. But then when you start talking about pancreatic cancer mimicking a lot of those same symptoms, that's when things start to get kind of into the weeds. Like, exactly what is it? Is this related to the surgery? Is it related to, you know, the therapy that patients are getting? Is it related to pancreatic injury from, for example, radiation? Hard to know, right? You're getting all these overlaps of symptoms. As the disease progresses, you certainly end up with all the digestive problems that we talked about earlier, where you really do start getting the side effects of wasting fat, so loss of fat. So next thing you know, you have significant steatorrhea and all the associated side effects of significant steatorrhea. And the best part is we're not really 100% sure what exactly is the underlying mechanism of EPI, right? We know that there's clearly something happening in the pancreas. It's probably tumor directly affecting, you know, the functioning of the acinar cells, and or obstructing the pancreatic duct. We're not sure about that either. But clearly, at the end of the day, what happens is that there's less of a pancreatic enzyme output into the duodenum. So why does this all matter? Because you do see differences between where the pancreas tumor happens to be and whether or not patients will present with EPI. So if the tumor is in the head of the pancreas, you're more likely to get EPI for all the things we just talked about, predominantly due to duct obstruction. So again, it's one of those things where if you're not paying attention, you're certainly going to miss this altogether. So going back to some of the treatments that we talked about earlier, so what do you think, when you see patients who are getting chemotherapy, is this often kind of mistaken for patients who have EPI, or vice versa? Is EPI kind of being mistaken for side effects of chemotherapy?
Both. Honestly, I wish that they were diagnosed before they started treatment. So we've actually been really proactive in meeting people on consult and not only talking about treatments and staging, but really nailing them down on their appetite and their food and having them, and Michelle will talk more about this, document their food and what they're tolerating and not tolerating before we put them on treatment, because putting them on treatment and then having those issues really does complicate it. But we actively screen everyone starting on consults. We find that like the testing, the diagnostic testing is extremely limited. So we don't actually utilize that here at the Cancer Center, which is why we jump in at consults and try to follow them closely with their diet and see if they need enzymes. Most people do need enzymes to some degree. And if in doubt, it's we do put them on it and see how they do afterwards. The ideal time is to start before treatment because we do give chemotherapy such as irinotecan that causes diarrhea, abdominal cramping, many of the same symptoms. So we really try to catch everyone before treatment. And if we can't, then it's we try to figure out what it is. Is it the chemo? Is it the enzyme? So we always start with the enzymes and take it from there.
But we probably should, just a priori assume that everyone with pancreatic cancer probably has an element of pancreatic insufficiency. It's one of those things that
Absolutely.
start thinking about it early on, and I'm sure Michelle will certainly talk about it shortly. We're going to put these patients way behind the eight ball nutritionally. A patient asked me
Right.
the other day, how is it that I will die with pancreatic cancer? Kind of a morbid hot topic, but why do people die with pancreatic cancer? Underlying some of this mortality is almost assuredly a problem with nutrition. So patients who are nutritionally set behind the eight ball kind of go downhill from there, and it becomes a bigger issue. So yeah, this is that's part of why we're discussing this today.
EPI until proven otherwise.
Exactly.
So we did touch on this, but the chemo-related GI issues and EPI. Do you see it after we start treatment when the patients come back to you?
Very, very commonly, right? What we start to think of is, again, for gastroenterologists, we're basically glorified plumbers. We basically think of plumbing problems first, right? So we're always thinking, okay, is there a gut problem? As we said earlier, gut failure. Is there a bile duct that's being blocked? Because you do obviously need bile to absorb fat. But more importantly, is the pancreatic duct obstructed? Well, more likely than not, the answer is yes. So if we see something that we can alleviate by changing the plumbing system around, then we absolutely should act on that. If it turns out that we find that just the pancreas itself is not functioning properly, again, with a combination of dietary management and enzymatic, supplementations, which we'll talk about shortly, then in fact, that's the way we kind of tackle it. It's always easy to just simply blame the chemotherapy, but more often than not, it's not the chemo side effects because they're being managed so well.
Right. Yeah, you definitely have to use clinical context to decipher whether treatment related or EPI. And quite often it could be both. So we actually do a lot of empiric management with PERT, with pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy. And we do follow them closely with their meals and have them log everything. Obviously, if the symptoms improve rapidly, EPI was contributing to their symptoms rather than the treatment. Our treatment side effects are very cyclical, so it's kind of easy to pin down if it's side effects of irinotecan or 5-FU or oxaliplatin versus EPI, if you listen close enough.
Going back to history being very important in this condition. No question
Yes.
about it. Yeah, basically I think we should probably talk a little bit about PERT, and then how does PERT work, and what are the best practices in its use, and that'll tie Michelle directly into this. More importantly, when people talk about enzyme replacement therapy, we're talking about really a very old-fashioned therapy, right? So going back to the late 1900s, patients were were diagnosed with patients were diagnosed patients were diagnosed entirely based on dog experiments, And we're talking about turn of the century, where it was discovered that some juice that the pancreas produces helps to absorb and digest fats. So it wasn't entirely clear what that was, but clearly we identified in dogs at the very least, and then ultimately in humans, that something the pancreas produces, some juice that the pancreas produces, is beneficial. You took the pancreas out of a dog, dogs didn't last very long. But why was that? And it was related to this enzyme. Currently, we don't use dog enzyme, we use pig enzyme. So if you think about all the different enzyme preparations that are out there, they are almost entirely derived from porcine sources. Why does that matter? Because if you think about the worldwide population of pigs, it's not limitless, and there is no synthetic currently commercially available pancreatic enzyme replacement. So at the core, we're still left with pigs being the source, and we're talking probably on the order of about 700 million pigs being sacrificed annually to produce the worldwide need for pancreatic enzyme replacement. So we're talking about mountains of pancreas, porcine pancreas in particular, being utilized to kind of replace what's missing in humans. As it turns out, thank goodness, if you formulate the pig enzyme properly, it could be very, very useful because it's comparable to human production of pancreatic enzyme. And more importantly, if you stop and thought about it, why is that even beneficial? Well, it like we said earlier, you're improving patients' nutritional profiles. You're able to have patients suddenly absorb fat where they weren't able to absorb fat. You're able to have patients digest proteins and carbohydrates where they couldn't do that in the past. And why does this all matter? I touched on it earlier, but there's actually empiric evidence that doing all of this not only improves quality of life, but may well improve survival, right? All this comes down to survival. There was a large retrospective analysis in 2018 that was published in Spain that showed in patients that had unresectable pancreatic cancer, if you gave patients who had EPI symptoms enzyme replacement therapy, they actually had longer survival. So there's actually proof in the pudding here that doing this, replacing enzyme for patients, actually, and there's evidence, obviously, like we just said, to support this, is actually beneficial. But more importantly, if you took survival out of the equation, we can make people kind of feel better. So Michelle, how quickly do you find that PERT works in these patients? Does the efficacy of PERT kind of, is it related to the kind of surgery patients have had? And more importantly, this is where patients and doctors kind of glaze over. What are the starting doses? The drug companies will come out and say there's 13 different formulations of PERT out there, and there's five or six different companies. Are they all the same? Are they all kind of different? What should we be thinking about as an audience to kind of do this? And more importantly, are there associated nutritional needs that the patients also will require?
Thank you, Dr. Legresti. There's a lot to cover. PERT can be very complex. It can work pretty quickly with patients, but the caveat is that it has to be the right dose, which I think can be challenging to get to initially. And like Dina was saying too, it could also be related to other factors like the chemotherapy, radiation, other treatments, or if there's other underlying GI issues going on. So it's challenging when we meet them when they've already started chemo to kind of figure out the difference. So like Dina was mentioning, we're trying to nail this down at a consult before they're starting treatments to see if we can initiate PERT and improve some of these symptoms prior to them starting chemo and then potentially getting them again. In terms of the types of surgery, Dr. Legresti, you could probably speak to this better, but I do think that the pancreatic head resection, so Whipples, are going to be a higher risk compared to the distal pancreatectomies. And then I also think that patients who are just advanced stage are at a higher risk as well. But like we were saying, it does seem like most of the pancreatic cancer patients could benefit from PERT. A lot of them have these symptoms. And we're seeing too, because they're being diagnosed so late, unfortunately, they already have these sort of late stage symptoms. They already have steatorrhea. They already have pretty significant weight loss. And so we're kind of fighting that battle before they're going on chemo, which could increase weight loss, decrease appetite, things like that. So we're trying to get there beforehand to get save some of that nutrition, save some of that strength while they're undergoing treatment.
Do you find compliance to be a big issue? I mean, clearly patients already have a boatload of things to do. The last thing they want to do is take 10 pills a day.
Correct. Yeah. Compliance is really difficult. And I think that when you present this to patients and we say you have to take this pill every time you eat, it's met with like a what? I'm not doing that. So it's challenging. It's definitely challenging. I think starting doses seem to be able to vary for patients depending on their weight. But I have read that kind of a standard dose of 48,000 units of lipase is a good place to start. I've also seen up to 72,000 units of lipase. So the different pancreatic enzymes come in different capsule levels. So Creon, for example, has a 24,000 capsule and a 36,000 capsule. So depending on the patient's starting weight, we might start them at two capsules of either one of those doses at meals and one capsule at snacks. They have to take it at the beginning of the meal. If they take it in the middle or the end, it's not going to work as well. But if they take it too far before they eat, it's not going to work as well. So compliance is tough, but compliance really is paramount to it working. So it's challenging, and I try to work with them pretty closely, give ideas on how we can, phone alarms, reminders, how can we figure out how to take these as they're prescribed so that we can see that benefit for the patients.
Yeah, and you alluded to it. I mean, the timing is probably just as important as the dosage. You know, if patients take the enzymes after they eat, far less effective than taking it with the food or even before the food. Is there some standardized formulas that we can be thinking about? How do we dose lipase exactly? You know, again, these are a little bit all over the place, but you look online, there are a number of formulas out there that people might be utilizing or even free apps.
Yeah, we're typically, I mean, actually, a lot of the pancreatic enzyme companies, they have standard kind of sheets where you can look at the patient's starting weight and it gives you suggestions on how many capsules to start with. So that's a good resource. In terms of kind of calculating things, we typically start with the lowest level dose of 500 units of lipase with their weight in kilograms, and then we kind of take it from there. But it's pretty individualized. So I think it can be challenging because it is so not standard. And you have to keep pretty close contact on them. And if they're not seeing improvement in a couple of days, I'm going to tell them to double their dose and see if that helps. But people don't like to
Yeah, and
take a
more
lot of
importantly,
pills.
a lot of these recommendations came about from cystic fibrosis pediatric patients. A lot of this has been very hard to
Correct.
extrapolate to adult patients with pancreatic cancer, right? Other end of the spectrum
Yes.
completely, but the data is what it is.
Yes, we have sometimes we'll see patients come in from outside facilities or from anywhere that are on much lower doses that are probably like more of a pediatric dose because I think that there can be some confusion sometimes in dosing these. So it's tough, but it really, when it works, they see such significant improvement in their quality of life that it's really important to try to make it work the best we can.
And expanding on that, Dina, patients who are doing this properly, do they have a better ability to tolerate cancer treatments?
Absolutely.
Education
Education
is really
is
important in this
really
regard because,
important
like
in this
Michelle said,
regard
that
because, like Michelle said,
patients don't want to take extra medications. A
patients
lot of them don't even want to take pain medicine for their cancer, let alone enzymes before every meal and snack. So if you do sit there and spend the time with them and say, hey, listen, your pancreas is busy right now. You cannot compete with all three. The cancer itself, the side effects of our treatments, and malnutrition, this is how this has to be taken.
it's
And this is
why.
why
If you
I
find
do find that people will do it. But if you're just saying, hey, these are pancreatic enzymes, take them before meals, they're going to be like, all right, maybe. Maybe. But if you sit there and explain the rationale, the reasoning, a lot of people do take it and they do take it appropriately. So education is really key. Although treating pancreatic insufficiency can't directly shrink or cure the cancer, we do find that it improves quality of life and treatment adherence by preventing malnutrition and unintentional weight loss to our treatments. That results in fewer interruptions in therapy and dose attenuations, which is very important for improving the disease. Do you ever experience in your practice people with religious or cultural beliefs and they're not able to take any pork products? Because we encounter that quite often.
Yeah, and as I said earlier, there is no synthetic version yet of lipase, which is kind of aggravating, but there isn't. All of this obviously stems from, you know, porcine sources, and obviously there are religious exemptions on treating patients who have this, and the religious prescriptions, I should say, on treating patients with porcine products, and at the same time, being adherent to religion. But more importantly, again, and this applies to both Judaism and Islam and Islamic patients, you know, we're always sitting back saying, underlying all this, well, the most important core tenet of the religion is preservation of life. So we always tell patients, if there is a significant concern, certainly talk to their rabbis and the imams, and they will be getting a dispensation almost assuredly, because the alternative would be kind of skipping the pancreatic enzyme altogether and getting all these side effects and doing poorly. And almost everyone will get a dispensation for this. And that's kind of what I fall back on. I always tell patients, consult with their rabbis, consult with their imams, because again, it's an important part of treatment. There's no other source really at this point that we can utilize effectively. And that brings me to speaking about other sources, Michelle. What about over the counter? You go on Amazon, you type in pancreatic enzyme supplementation, you'll probably receive 20 hits right off the bat on over the counter pancreatic enzymes. Are they the same?
There are a lot of over-the-counter pancreatic enzymes, and they are absolutely not the same. Well, actually, I couldn't even say if they're the same, right? Because they're not FDA regulated. We don't even fully know what's in them, but my guess is they're not the same. They definitely don't have as much strength-wise as the prescription dose. And so because of that, and because, again, not FDA regulated, we don't encourage over-the-counter use of the pancreatic enzymes. We do have patients that occasionally use it if, for some reason, the pork derived piece is a significant problem that they can't get past, or another problem could be if they can't get it covered by their insurance, or if there's things going on where they can't get the medication. But it's pretty rare, and we really try our best to go the route of the prescription. And again, like you said, you can Google it and find like 20 different brands, you know, and there's nothing about any of them. There's no research, there's nothing that could tell us if it's good or not. So we try to steer clear of that the best we can.
Yeah, hard to know how they're formulated. More importantly, what are they dose equivalent for lipase? They're all plant-based, so presumably there's some benefit, but who the heck knows what the benefit is? And I tell people, unless cost is prohibitive, you know, stick with the ones that are available by prescription.
Exactly.
Are there any resources out there to help patients with cost? As we said earlier, these can be very expensive undertakings, lots of pills and lots of different choices.
There are.
We have that issue every day.
Yeah.
Dina and I are always talking about this. Yeah, so there actually are a lot of resources. A lot of the pharmaceutical companies do offer different assistance programs, savings cards, depending on the insurance that they have and how the coverage works. I know Creon, Pertzi, and ZenPep all have assistance programs. So if your insurance doesn't cover it, you can apply through the application process to get covered that way, free of charge or at a discounted rate. If it is covered, but they have a really high copay, all three of those also have savings programs. So it's just a matter of finding those resources. And I will say that they actually are easy to find when you know where to look, and they're really helpful. So we're constantly enrolling our patients into these assistance programs to try to get them the prescriptions that they need at a lesser cost.
Yeah, we often rely on the drug companies to give us samples, because honestly, a lot of these patients are Medicare patients, and patients on Medicare, generally these prescription drug programs don't really apply. So we're left with, they only apply to young people with commercial insurances. Fat lot of good that's going to do the average patient with pancreatic cancer who's Medicare age, and it's going to be a big problem. But again, we have to keep in mind, you know, cost cannot be taken out of this equation.
Right.
All right. So it looks like we're getting to the end. I'll hit on some of the closing and key takeaway points to this talk today, and then we'll see if we can do literally a minute or two on some questions. If you fall back on why we did this today, why we think this is an important topic, other than the fact that we do this every day, is that, you know, there are no standardized guidelines that are published in the United States for treating patients with pancreatic cancer and pancreatic insufficiency. And there should be, right? Again, when we're, you know, telling patients that they have a fatal disease, we're going to try to make them feel better. This is one of the ways we could make patients feel better, right? It improves a whole bunch of things like we touched on earlier. Patients certainly, a priori, when they arrive in Dina and Michelle's office, they have pancreatic insufficiency almost assuredly. And all of those patients should be considered, like, right off the bat, as you're talking about all the other things that they need, they in fact need to think about being on pancreatic enzyme therapy. But more importantly, going back to what we said about lack of standardized guidelines, there's also a lot of limited high quality clinical evidence for any of this. It's not like these are, sexy topics that require lots of money being spent and lots of interest. Pancreatic cancer is not common. So it's one of those things where thank goodness for the National Pancreas Foundation being out there promoting these kinds of things. Care oftentimes is based on anecdote and not high quality evidence. But we know it definitely works. And more importantly, again, as you see here, this is good multidisciplinary care today. Again, care oftentimes in the real world is fragmented, right? So if you think about, a recent survey, they asked surgical oncologists, do you think pancreatic enzyme therapy is really good? And almost assuredly, everybody said it was absolutely the best therapy ever, other than surgery. And then when they actually were in practice, only about 20% of surgeons prescribed pancreatic enzymes. So again, that goes back to what we started talking about here, which is that knowledge is power. So let me just cover some of the questions that are in the little Q&A thing here. One question says, or one statement says, our clinic is a huge advocate for EPI evaluation and PERT. Do you all have a good plan B when a patient is a vegan and cannot afford the enzymes and they were declined by their assistance program? I know the gold standard would be prescription grade, but I just wanted your take. So what do you guys think? Basically, you've tried everything, you've exhausted everything, and you still can't get a patient on PERT. What do you do?
I mean, I think that's where we have to go to the over-the-counter doses and at least try it. That seems like that's our only option, right? The other thing, is that we could limit their fat in their diet to decrease some of the symptoms, but then that sort of takes away a lot of the calories that we want them to consume. Most have lost a ton of weight, so that can contribute more to that. So I would say, we would try the over-the-counter, but it's tough. I mean, we try to do everything we can to get these prescriptions. And like you said, Dr. Legresti, we also have samples if needed. So we do what we can to get it for them. They really need it. And it's tough that this situation even comes up.
Now the flip side is, and this goes back to Dina, what is the downside of taking too much? Is too much of a good thing a bad thing?
Yes, absolutely. We've seen people on too high of a dose, and your dose requirements can change over time. And I tell that to people once they're actually taking it compliantly, is that your dose can change over time, and that can be mixed up with chemo side effects as well, right? We give so much nausea medicine to prevent and treat nausea that we can cause constipation, and the same thing with the enzymes. If the enzyme dose is too high, that can cause constipation too, and then you lose your compliance that you initially had. But to circle back to the last question, that happens very rarely for us that we can't get them some pancreatic enzymes through foundation or assistance. I mean, I can think over, the past 10 years, only a handful of patients have had that happen. It really doesn't happen very often, thankfully.
And then there's a question specifically for you, Dina. Have you seen porcine allergies causing troubles taking PERT?
I haven't. It's been more cultural. It's been more cultural, and they have done over the counter, and they weren't very successful with that. But I haven't seen any allergies, which is good.
Thank goodness. Not too many
Have
people
you seen
allergic
any?
to bacon.
Michelle hasn't
No,
encountered any either.
I haven't seen any either.
We
More
didn't go
cultural.
through. We also didn't touch on this, which I think was just as important, but probably because of lack of time. What about diagnosis, right? So if someone has three stool fecal elastase tests and all three of them are showing different readings, one is low, one's normal, one's medium, what does any of that mean? And more importantly, these stool tests being done in settings of acute pancreatitis, does that matter? And I'll kind of touch on that briefly. Fecal elastase is one of our kind of a surrogate tests for pancreatic insufficiency. The true tests for pancreatic insufficiency are generally far too cumbersome to use clinically. One would be a challenge test. You give someone an enzyme called secretin, an enzyme, a hormone called secretin, and it then is you use that to measure how much the pancreas actually produces in relationship to that. That's cumbersome and not really done. And then the other alternative is measuring how much fecal fat output there is. And again, the quick test for single dose of fecal fat, that is used pretty relatively useless. You need to do a collection over 24 to 72 hours. Again, super cumbersome, multiple paint cans filled with stool being mailed to the lab. not something that generally we want to do. So we use fecal elastase. So fecal elastase, and it doesn't really correlate with a lot of times patients' symptoms. Oftentimes, if it's associated with patients who have lots of diarrhea, it's diluted, so it's inaccurate. But it gives us kind of a rough ballpark figure as to whether or not the pancreas is doing what it's supposed to do. It's a protease that's produced by the pancreas exclusively. So if it's low, then presumably patients have pancreatic insufficiency. And you get all these different tiers of levels, greater than 200, more less than 200, meaning something. And oftentimes, the very, very low levels of fecal elastase are probably the most helpful. They tell us, some degree of as to whether or not patients are having pancreatic insufficiency. And again, you would think it would be a great test to kind of monitor patients. It's not so great for that. When patients are getting pancreatic enzyme replacement, you can't really use the fecal elastase to judge whether they're getting enough pancreatic enzyme replacement. So it's a good test. It's not a great test. It's one of those few tests that we have to use relatively easily. The good thing is that it's an easy test to do. It's stable on the shelf. Patients can have stool sitting around for 7 days and it's still accurate. So it's useful for that purpose. And then one of the final questions is there's a question about whether there's any correlation between exocrine pancreatic insufficiency leading to pancreatic cancer. And that's kind of interesting because it may not lead to pancreatic cancer, but there was one very nice abstract in 2024 ASCO, which showed that exocrine pancreatic insufficiency was a possible predictor of pancreatic cancer development. And they found that it wasn't exactly the world's best study, but again, it was a decent retrospective observational study, and they found that over a 3-year period, they found more patients who had pancreatic cancer had EPI leading up to it. So certainly an important thing to kind of be a take-home message. EPI may not be, in fact, just simply a side effect of pancreatic cancer, but it may be kind of the other way around. I want to thank you all. Thanks to my colleagues in oncology and dietary, kind of really helping us out here, and kind of presenting these facts to the population at large.
Thank you for having us.